When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Donald Trump says his very talented daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, should run the RNC. We have such a great show for you today. MSNBC legal analyst Andrew Weissman stops by to debunk all things her. Then we will talk to Harvard professor Theda Skocpol about how the right wing is mutating. But first, we have the host of The Bulwark Daily, The Bulwark's Tim Miller. Welcome back to Fast Politics, fan favorite, Tim Miller.
All right, give me that gold watch.
I'm going to give you a minute of plugging. Tim is now the daily host of the Bulwark podcast, which means every fucking day you can get Tim Miller.
In your ears. Every day.
That's right, baby.
And then even sometimes twice when I come hang out with Molly Jongfast.
You know? The melodious sounds of Tim Miller.
I did mention when I did the handoff from Charlie, I don't really have his radio voice. You know, he had that beautiful cadence and the dulcet tone. And I said, you're going to have to substitute that beauty for my snark. You know, hopefully the laughs will overshadow the vocal fry.
Well, I, as a practitioner of vocal fry myself, he does have a real dulcet. I mean, he is like from the radio world that doesn't exist anymore, which is why we love him and think he's so really important. So let's talk for a minute about, I have a piece coming out today, so I always have to plug my work in other venues. No, I'm just kidding. But the anxiety election. Because that's basically what this is, right?
Yeah. And I haven't read your piece, so I'd look forward to reading it. And but we all have anxiety. And I think this explains, I talked about this a little bit at the end of the Monday Bulwark Pod. People are mad at each other right now if they have different opinions about like the right strategic approach. You know, like all of us on the same team, like the anti-Trump pro-democracy team, like there's a lot of infighting happening right now. It's like, oh, you're being too mean to Biden. It's like, oh, no, we're actually trying to help by pointing out that this is a real problem that needs to be solved. And it's like, no, if you mention age, then you might as well be a Trump or just put your red hat back. And it's kind of like everybody needs to take a breath. Tensions are high. Anxiety is high for good reason, because the threat is so big. And it's like everybody that's on the same side, like if somebody has a different strategic approach, approach than you. It's okay to listen to. It's okay to say that's a dumb idea, actually. But it's also okay just to listen and say, okay, how can we work this through to put the good guys in the best position for victory possible 9 months from now? And I think that there's just the nerves are fraying discussing that for sure.
I think that's really right. I also think that what you're saying about the stakes is really important, right? The thing that's like so hard for me as I watch it is like 2016, we thought, okay, Trumpism, it's not going to win. Then, and I kept saying, oh, he's going to win, you guys. And everybody was like, no, no, he's not going to win. So, okay, so then he wins. Then there's this feeling in 2020, you know, if you ignore him, he'll go away. What happens instead is that he poisons what little was left of the Republican Party. And now there are like, what was heartening was the Senate vote yesterday on foreign aid, right? Foreign aid. This is like what Reagan ran on. Foreign aid, right? Like, this is what we do. We are the country where, you know, we protect. Again, I personally, it's not my worldview, but like, you know, Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Obama, you know, we are the shining city on the hill. Again, not my personal view.
What? You don't think we're shining? You don't think we're on a hill, Molly? We're not the land of milk and honey?
I get itchy with nation building. But okay. The point is, here it is. This is like a central tenet of American democracy. And the numbers were pretty good in the Senate. I was actually surprised that they were so high. But then Mike Johnson was like, no, we're not going to do that.
Well, anytime you're heartened, I like to just kind of rip that heart out and bring in the darkness. Yeah, I was not that heartened.
29
I am not at all itchy about jingoism. So those are just two areas of disagreement. USA. So here's the problem. Two things happened in the past couple of days that are disheartening for me. On this bill, you're right. It passed 70 votes. That's good. And I think that is very important for Ukraine in the short. Ukraine needs this because if they don't, like it's handing this thing over to Putin. And the time is ticking on having a window to do this. So that was important. The problem is 39 Senate Republicans voted for it 2 years ago, down to 22. So it's moving the wrong direction. Let me tell you, umpteen people didn't change their mind. Okay. Like they just are bowing to pressure from the base, which wishes this bill was killed for the most part, a majority of the party. Then the other little nugget I want to throw on top of there is Mike Gallagher, that little coward, left the Congress from Wisconsin at age 39. He's the one that all of my friends who are still in the Republican world like hang their hat on. Like, there are still some good Republicans. Look at Mike Gallagher. Well, Mike Gallagher voted against impeachment, so he's not that good. He leaves. This is the old Adam Smith. You know, markets, supply and demand. This is my free marketism coming back in. Free market is at work in the Republican Party. The demand from the voters is for MAGA. It's for isolationism. It's for bigotry. You know, it's for closing borders. And if you are the type of candidate that does not like all that stuff, you're either checking out voluntarily like Mike Gallagher, or you're losing in primaries, or you're very old and in the Senate and people are waiting for you to be pushed out. Okay. That's like, yeah. That is it. Like the things are moving inexorably the wrong direction with the GOP. That said, it's good for Ukraine. Hopefully they can figure out a way to get this up for a vote in the House, because it would pass if it got up for a vote. It's just a question about whether MAGA Mike Johnson has the stones to just block it.
It's so interesting, Mike Johnson. I want to have a minute on Mike Johnson. One of the weird things about Trumpism is that you get jobs that you absolutely are not qualified for because no one else will do them.
Yes.
Right? Like the whole Trump administration, you'd be like, you're the undersecretary of what? And it was like, well, the other choice was like a guy who was like somebody's cousin.
That is true. I had a whole kind of chapter about these people in the book about how like you just these strivers that got into Trump world that they had no chance getting this job in any other administration. Like the idea that Sean Spicer would have been the press secretary for any other Republican president, like, is insane. Like nobody would ever have picked him. You could say that about all of his press secretaries, really. And so it like self-selects people that are like particularly sociopathic, right?
Right,
because
exactly.
They're like, I am so ambitious that I am willing to take a job for a guy that has no loyalty and that I recognize is completely morally repugnant because this is my one chance to do it. And so that is like not really a great personality trait to have for people running the country.
I think that's a very good point. So Trump has now, he controls the House of Representatives, or at least he feels he does. Not a huge majority, but he feels he has it. He is in a power struggle with Mitch McConnell to try to get him out so he can control the Senate, right? Which Republicans don't control, but they hope they will soon. And then the RNC. Now, you have some RNC experience here.
I do.
As an outsider, it seems to me like Ronna, Mitt Romney's niece, has the worst job in the entire world. But still, Trump wants to give it to his daughter-in-law. Discuss.
Lot there. Yeah, I mean, Ronna Romney had the worst job in the world and somehow managed to keep it for like over a half decade. Like, despite being the worst party chairman in modern political history and being miserable, it's hard to understand it. I guess she just liked those Mar-a-Lago cougar parties so much that she couldn't give them up. But yeah, so she gets pushed out. Now, Trump is going to push in a guy that was the North Carolina party chair for the head gig. And this guy was famous basically for claiming to Trump that Trump won North Carolina because they did such a good job of shutting down the fraud. Like, you know, they put in the good machines in North Carolina, Mr. Trump. Fantastical lies about the 2020 election are how you advance yourself in the Republican Party now. So he gets the main job, and then Trump is going to have his daughter-in-law as the co-chair, you know, just to make sure that he has somebody on the inside in case he needs the party to like write checks for his legal defense or whatever, you know, just to make sure that any kind that there's a question of, well, whether the party should do the right thing or whether it should just be a service to Trump. Yeah. They'll make sure there's a Trump family member on the phone call to hear if there are any dissenters in the building. It's very third world. It's very like Belarusian.
It is. It's very like Banana Republic, right? Are we allowed to say Banana Republic? Yes.
Yeah, I think so.
It's interesting to me. Like, part of the reason why Trump has decided it's Ronna's time to go, partially it's because he wants the RNC to pay his legal bills. The excuse he's using is that she's not raising enough money for him. Would anyone else do a better job? I mean, I'm sorry to like do this, but and I'm hardly a fan of Ronna, but it seems to me like this is like one of these times where Trump isn't like picking Carrie Lake to run for Senate after she is already the governor. It's one of these things where it's so incredibly self-destructive and stupid. You have to pause and be like, what?
Yeah, and did you ever watch the TV series about Chernobyl? You know, yes, like these like Soviet like systems where everybody is in service to one God King. Like, there are some flaws, okay? You know, because people lie and there's backstabbing, and so yeah, it's scary that Trump and these guys are out there and that he's winning in the polls. But like, the internal processes are not efficient. Like, this is not a well operating machine here. Okay, it's hard to see how somebody could raise more money. Like, the question is, who would you raise more money from? Like, they are already juicing the $10 MAGA donors.
And those people are going to Trump.
Yeah. Like, those people are already giving to Trump. So that, like, there's not a lot of juice left on that orange, right? And so then it's like, then you go to the big donors and they're going to give to the RNC for what? Right? Like the RNC has to give them a rationale that they're going to do something that is useful to those guys. And they're like, if you're them, like, why wouldn't you just give money to, you know, Mitch McConnell, right? Like the NRSC or somebody right, like hoping.
Or Nikki Haley.
Yeah, or Nikki, right? So I'm with you. It's hard to see how, I think that they're in a really bad way, kind of at least organizationally. Unfortunately, there's some other things that are working in their favor right now, but they're organizationally, they're in a bad spot.
Do we have enough information to go on? Like, we in the media industrial complex who are in a full-on freak out about everything right now about this anxiety election, like, what is the information we are going on, right? Because like, the polls are bad, but the polls have been consistently bad. And like, for example, I had this guy on who did this piece for The Economist. He's a recovering pollster. And he talked about how actually the really good polls have Biden down by 0.5. And this is something we've seen since 2018, flooding the zone with junky polls to help MAGA candidates. So like, there's certainly some of that going on, right? Like, that's not to say that Biden is like, but I'm just saying, like, I do wonder, we're not getting great information here. And I'm not sure we're transmitting great information either. Like, it's a country of hundreds of millions of people. Like, how many are actually reading the New York Times?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that two things are true here. One is that it's just hard to judge. We don't have full information on how to judge what a Trump-Biden matchup is going to really look like. in February for a couple of reasons. One, that we don't know exactly what the third party situation is going to be. Two, I think that there's a lag on economic kind of response, right? The economy's been getting better, but it takes people a while. You know, you have to do your bills for a few months before you realize that you're like, oh, actually, like things are looking up, right? Before you, you know, look at your Charles Schwab account or whatever and say, oh, okay.
And that's the Harry Truman's transitory inflationary argument, which is Truman had this massive transitory inflation after World War II that pundits thought Dewey would ride to re-election, and that did not happen.
Right. Yeah. So there's a delay. So I think that there's and you see some of this. We could do a whole history lesson, but you've seen some of this in many presidential elections. And then there's the Trump. I do think that we don't really know what Haley voters are going to do, because like the Trump of it all hasn't sunken in yet. You know, that it's like it's really going to be this asshole. It's just starting to sink in with normies. So all that stuff, I think that the polls will be not perfect, but just a better indicator in April than it is now. And I think we'll have a better sense of the state of play in April or May. I do think, though, it is just reality that like people are worried about Biden's age, right? Like that's not bad information. It's like people are worried about it. How much are they worried about it? Are they so worried about it that they might vote for a third party or Trump? You know, I don't think that we really know the second question yet, but I think it's pretty clear from the numbers that people are worried about it.
Right. I mean, I think that denial doesn't do anything for anyone, right? But I also do think we don't have great mechanisms for telling what's going on, right? Like, I mean, Sarah Longwell does these focus groups, so she at least is like in there with voters. I mean, I talked to someone at the White House who said that they do a lot of focus groups. And one of the things they see is that it's very hard to dislike Biden. You can think he is too old, but you don't dislike him. And I wonder how much that is actually an important bit of data right there, right? Like that the candidate, that even if you have a candidate who is old and who you feel for whatever reason, you don't like the fact that he's old. One of the things with Hillary was that I say this as a feminist who spends a lot of time thinking about why women candidates have such a terrible time in this country. I just wonder if being an old white guy actually serves.
Yeah, maybe. And I mean, this was the key. I mean, the difference between Hillary and Biden was just the intensity of that dislike, right? I mean, Biden won, basically, you can just cut away all the other BS. And it's like voters who told pollsters, I don't like Hillary and I don't like Trump, mostly voted for Trump. Voters who told pollsters, I don't like Trump and I don't like Biden, mostly voted for Biden. Like there could be a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is almost certainly that, which is why it makes it hard sometimes to interpret the polls, is like the intensity of the unfavorability, right? Like they were intensely unfavorable towards Hillary, and to Biden, it's like, I don't really like him. He's not my cup of tea, but like, okay. And so, you know, I definitely think that there's a gender element to it. I think that there's a conservative media complex attacking Hillary, you know, to it. I think that some of it was self-inflicted. We just know that that is true based on the results from 16 to 20.
It is interesting, too, though, that the conservative media has decided to attack, and they've been doing this attack, right, basement Biden since 2020. But it is interesting to me that the attack they're using is that Biden gets stuff wrong and seems out of it, and their guy suffers from the very same problem, right? Like, even if you're just going to say, like, even if you take this attack and say it's true, I don't think it's true, but okay. But you are running someone who you could make the exact same attack on.
Yeah, dude doesn't do anything. And he goes to court and golfs. I saw one of his defenders said recently that he was golfing so much now because he knows he's not going to have time once he's saving the country as president. Like, what? He has four trials and we're in the middle of an election. Like that is just not believable. I mean, the videos you see of Trump are like how many videos have you seen of Biden just randomly showing up to people's weddings and walking around to say hello?
Well, Trump, though, Trump world people say Trump can't do as many events as he used to be able to. And I think about 2016, like watching him zip across the country. Remember, like you do a rally and then you get on his plane, you do another rally, you know, so it is. I just wonder if your attack on the Democrat can be very well repurposed to be the attack on the Republican. I don't know that's a great place to be in.
No, I concur. I concur. It's not a good place to be in. But, you know, again, you just go back to this whole, it shouldn't he be in a worse place, right? And, you know, you can go round and round on this. But I think that he has some very, very real vulnerabilities. And I think that some of them are not showing up in the polls yet. There's a little bit of a lag. And God willing, they start.
Tim Miller. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Molly Jong Fast, anytime. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you. You're the best.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to think, I'm covered, no worries, right? Well, not so fast. What about your out-of-pocket costs? That can be a lot of money for you and your family. And if you're like me, you can't help but wonder, was I overbilled? You're not alone. It's estimated that over 50% of medical bills contain errors. Unless you're a billing expert, how do you know your medical bills are accurate? That's why I want to tell you about HealthLock. What is HealthLock? It's a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your family's insurance. When your medical claims come in, HealthLock technology reviews the claims for errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. HealthLock makes it easy to find and fix hidden errors, so you pay only what you owe. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. Bottom line, insurance alone isn't enough. HealthLock finds medical bill errors before you pay. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Did you know Rick Wilson and I are bringing together some friends for a general election kickoff party at City Winery in New York on March 6th? We're going to be chatting right after Super Tuesday about what's going on, and it is going to probably be the one fun night for the next 80 days. If you're in the New York area, please come by and join us. You can go to City Winery's website and grab a ticket. Andrew Weissman is the co-host of the MSNBC podcast, Prosecuting Donald Trump, and the co-author of The Trump indictments, there are a lot of them. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Andrew Weissman.
Hey, Molly. So great to be here.
I love having you, and I love running into you, and I'm glad we're friends. And
totally.
I also really like you as a human on this earth, of which hopefully we'll be here for a while. But I wanted to talk to you, not to get too dark.
We're going
to
go really, really dark, really fast.
Really fast. One of the many things I like about you is that you have had a lot of these jobs. So while I can speculate all I want, you've actually worked on the you've worked in a special counsel investigation. You've been in the Mueller investigation. You've sort of been in those places where the rest of us can only speculate. So I feel like your take on her is much more meaningful than pretty much 99.999% of the world, with the exception of Eric Holder, who I think was pretty pissed.
He did, although I have to say, I don't think he's ever been on a special counsel. But by the way, I don't
right.
I actually agree with you that Eric Holder is, obviously, he's been the attorney general and has incredible experience.
I was shocked when I saw that tweet. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. People have said all sorts of very interesting things. I mean, one of the things that I think he has said is, why is he even asking what the date is of the death of Joe Biden's son? I didn't realize he was giving a memory test. I mean, how does that even come up?
You also were appointed by George W. Bush in a world when things were normal. So you really understand the sort of the nonpartisan space that is supposed to be the DOJ.
I have served since 1991. I've served under, I think, every attorney general since then in various capacities. So I think Mary McCord and I talk about this, which is until the Trump era, you didn't think about politics at all in your job. It just was irrelevant. And then when I was on the Mueller investigation, it suddenly was a big thing. And it's so funny because now people think of me as some far left liberal, whereas
right.
Most of my friends are liberal. You were
right.
in the government for 21 years. I teach at NYU Law School. I can tell you, I'm not viewed as liberal there. It's sort of the warping of norms and perceptions that has happened, I think, during the Trump era. And I mean Trump era, whether he's president or running for president.
I want you to talk us through the decision to pick her. And I think it comes back to the decision to pick Merrick Garland. In 2020, the world looked a little different, right? There was a sense that maybe if Democrats, though we weren't warned, I want to say this because I think it's important. We were warned by certain experts in authoritarianism that Democrats would not be able to just pretend that things were normal and go back to norms and that it would all work like that. But they tried. And I think that in appointing Merrick Garland, Biden was trying to say, here's a guy who was a judge. Just talk us through what you think Biden was doing by putting Merrick Garland in the job and then subsequently what he was doing by picking her.
I think that's a great place to start because there's a lot to be said and there's a lot that has been said about the Hur report itself. But it's useful, I think, to pull back the camera to what's a secondary issue, but a really important one, and in many ways, maybe the bigger issue. So I think that in picking Merrick Garland, Joe Biden was doing, frankly, what he said he was doing, which is that he views the Department of Justice as apolitical and its individual charging decisions would be made independently of the White House, and they need to be made independently of the White House. In other words, as a break from the sort of unitary executive. Why? But precisely because it's not appropriate to have Donald Trump, when he was president, saying, let's go after Democrats and not go after Republicans.
Right.
I want them to not charge my friends. I want them to dismiss those cases. I mean, so this was a way to say, you know what? Who's going to have more integrity than somebody who has years ago been at the department, so he's aware of how it works, but he's been a very respected judge for over 20 years, the D.C. Circuit, and, by all accounts, is an honorable, good person. And I think nothing that's happened in any way makes me doubt any of that in terms of his being acting in good faith and being a brilliant, smart, lovely, thoughtful, empathetic person. As you can tell, but I do have a but coming,
right?
Which is that I think that the appointment that where you say in order to investigate Democrats, you need to have a Republican appointed as a prosecutor.
A la Ken Starr.
Right. And the idea is like it's a Republican who is looking into Hunter Biden. But by the same token, it's a Republican who's looking into Mike Pence. So it's like Republicans investigate Republicans and Republicans investigate Democrats. Right. And it's Republicans who investigate Republicans because you would be subject to attack if you had a Democrat there. But you have a Republican investigate Democrats because if you appointed a Democrat, you would say, oh, they're going to pull their punches. So no matter what, you had Merrick Garland appointing Republicans for all of these things. I think that that sort of taking the easy road up front of, oh, don't want to have an attack on me for doing this. I want to show that I'm bending over backwards, buys into one, that's a political decision, a small p political decision. And you're there precisely because you weren't supposed to take politics into account. That if you are picking the best person for the job, come on. You think all three of those people just happen to be the best person for the job? I mean, it's like what Bush said about Clarence Thomas. I mean, come on. By the way, I'm not saying that you shouldn't consider race and the appointment to the Supreme Court. I think you should. I just don't think you should deny it. And so here, I think you're buying into the idea that people don't act out of principle. And it was an overreaction to the attack on Mueller and his team, of which, you know, as you said, I was one, and is a kind of thing that I think missed an opportunity to educate the public about why you're not going to be looking at the party politics of somebody, that it's irrelevant in the department. I understand why he did it. I just think it was the wrong decision. And I would say that, by the way, even if I thought the Hur report was flawless, it's just you are buying into the idea that people cannot be impartial. And you know what? Judges can be impartial. Jurors can be impartial. Prosecutors can be impartial. And so you don't sit there and pick a jury by saying, oh, listen, it's a Republican on trial. So by the way, all of you have to be Republicans, you know, right?
Right. The thing is, Democrats playing by these 2012 rules. The assumption here is that Hur will not be a partisan, that Hur will go into this committed to the truth. And I think this is true. And you tell me if you think this is true. When you read the report, and I thought Joe Scarborough summed up so succinctly, he couldn't indict him legally, so he indicted him politically. There's so much editorializing. And so the reality is he's not there to talk about what he thinks about Joe Biden neurologically. He just isn't.
I agree. And I think there are two ways to look at what Rob Hur did. I think in terms of the substance of what he found, it was presented in a way that I thought was misleading.
Will you talk about that a little more?
Yeah. So Ryan Goodman, who's a professor at NYU with me, we wrote a piece for Just Security. He's one of the managing editors of it. It's a legal forum that's really terrific. It has wonderful pieces on the website. So we did a piece on Saturday where one of the things we did is posited another way the introduction could have been written that would have been very clear as to what it was finding and what it wasn't finding. What we were reacting to was that in the news, I won't say uniformly, but major outlets reported that Rob Hur found that Joseph Biden had in fact committed a felony, but that they were not recommending prosecution because of discretionary reasons like his age or his memory.
I mean, this is what somebody transmitted to Trump, which made him so furious because he was like, well, then they shouldn't prosecute me either.
Right. So that is not what he found. And we cite over and over again the passages from this 400-page plus report, but the introduction was particularly inept in the way it was done or intentionally misleading. I'm not going to speculate about the intent for it. I'm just saying that one of the things we did in our piece was we wrote a different way the introduction could have been written that would have been 100% accurate and would have been very, very clear that there was evidence to open the case because, of course, there was classified documents found where they shouldn't have been. So there's a basis to open the case. But the key issue is knowledge and intent and whether this was willful, meaning that you had knowledge of the documents, you knew that they were classified and national defense information, and you knew you were doing something wrong. And over and over and over again, one, two, or three of those things were not present. And over and over again, her later in the report says that, and he says there are innocent explanations that could not be refuted. I'm paraphrasing, but that's like on page six. He says, they're innocent explanations we cannot refute. In fact, he says, they're innocent explanations we found evidence in favor of, affirmative evidence to prove. You know what that means as a prosecutor? You cannot go forward. If they're innocent explanations that you cannot refute, that actually means innocence.
Right. But it's written in such a way that...
I mean, how about they're innocent explanations that are true?
Right.
So that's sort of one aspect which has gotten less attention, which is that the report's getting misreported.
Right. Because reading comprehension is fucking hard. I say this as someone who myself has failed.
And then the second piece, which of course has gotten lots of attention, is the embroidery, the sort of James Comey 2.0 aspect of this, which is positing what would happen at a trial that's not going to happen, right? You're not going to bring a case, but you're now speculating at that trial, which I'm not going to bring. It is possible that Joseph Biden will testify, which you don't know. And if he testifies, he could say, I have a bad memory, which, by the way, is also irrelevant because what his memory is like today is irrelevant to what his memory was at the time that the documents were found. And by the way, I'm also going to speculate that at this trial that's not happening, where he may testify, but I don't know if he will, I'm going to then say, he's going to say that I do have a bad memory. That was, by the way, disproved within 24 hours when Joseph Biden, of course, said, I don't have a bad memory. So everything about it was so gratuitous. It just was not needed. And that's where, to go back to your point about I worked on a special counsel investigation, just to be slightly in the weeds, don't worry, it won't be too boring or too long. A special counsel is a person who is part of the Department of Justice. You are not outside of the Department of Justice, and the special counsel rules require, it's not optional, it is required that you adhere to Department of Justice policies. Nothing about the special counsel rules exempt you. In fact, the special counsel rules say you can be fired if you do not follow Department of Justice guidelines. One of those is that you do not denigrate people if you are not charging them. I'm just paraphrasing it. In fact, you know, you can't denigrate people even if you are charging them. People have gotten in trouble for bringing an indictment and then giving a press conference where they then start denigrating somebody. That's something you're not supposed to do. Your personal opinion, those kinds of issues, you leave aside. And as people have probably heard who are listening to this podcast, you speak in court. And so this was just not adhering to the best traditions of the department. And I guess I would say at the very least, it showed incredibly poor judgment. And the best example of that is, even if you thought it was appropriate to talk about Joe Biden's memory, that you would choose to talk about his son?
I just don't know how that's relevant.
Even if you thought it was relevant. In other words, even if you could cobble together some convoluted, fanciful theory, that you would choose that example tells you much more about Rob Herr than Joe Biden. It is so classless and shows such a poor sense of propriety and respect. I mean, it was truly shocking. You know, I kept on thinking of constantly saying, like, you know, who raised you? Right. I could just see if I did anything like that, my parents calling me up and saying, I don't know who raised you. Like, you know, you weren't raised by wolves. That's not appropriate behavior.
It feels like when you read it, I think you were the one who said this, but somebody said or wrote that part of what it looks like is her trying to have a long future in Trump world, that there's so much gratuitous stuff with that. I mean, do you think that's true?
You know, I don't know what's going on in his head. We certainly have seen instances where people have done that, and it's like a tryout for a senior position in the Justice Department.
Like the Bill Barr memo, right?
Exactly. I'm not going to go there as to what was running through his head. I just know what's on paper, and I can judge that. And I don't think one needs to even get to his motivations. I mean, you can speculate. There are certainly ways in which there could be those improper motivations. But even if it was well-intentioned, it was still inappropriate.
Right. It's hard to imagine it's well-intentioned. Now, Republicans are incredibly excited and think that they have a sort of great way to stick it to Biden. So they're going to have now hearings where he's going to testify. And will they be able to play the audio? Is there a precedent for playing audio from these interviews? I've never heard it, but
it's hard because I don't think we've seen all that. But I mean, I'm sure there'll be an effort to try and get the transcripts and the audio and to like play this on a loop. I have to say, my view on that issue, the sort of the underlying issue of does the president have memory problems that would make it inappropriate or difficult for him to serve? I don't really care what Rob Herr has to say. He's another right. person. I mean, right. that's where people shouldn't buy into giving him any more weight than I don't think people, like, I didn't care what James Comey had to say about Hillary Clinton. We could all make our own judgment. I don't need Rob Herr or James Comey to tell me that. I think that's one where I can leave that aside. If there's an issue that either Donald Trump or Joe Biden has as to their fitness in terms of their policies, their character, their memory, their health, whatever it is, they can go ahead and talk about it and they right. can present evidence. And that's the way they should deal with it. To my mind, this is not a particular point of interest.
But is there a precedent for playing the audio?
I don't know if it's in this exact context, but you can certainly, if you were calling somebody, you could, and there was audio or there was a transcript, you could try and get that information and then use it. I'm sure there's a transcript of it. And I think the White House is still considering what to do because they have to do a classification review. So I think there's going to be more to come on that. But at the very least, there would be a transcript, but there could be audio as well.
But the fact that this is being released, I mean, there, like I think about the Mueller report, right? And there was a lot of hemming and hawing about the Mueller report. And then in the end, we saw Bill Barr was like, this is too long to read. Don't worry. It's fine. Our guy didn't do anything wrong. Trump world politicized the report and the way it was released. There was just much more sort of couching and partisanship around it. I sort of almost wondered why Biden world. I mean, I understand why they didn't do more of that, but I wondered if Democrats are like still not meeting the moment here.
Yeah. So one, guess what, Molly? I still remember that.
Me too.
I wrote this book about the Mueller investigation. And it starts with that. It starts with the moment.
And you were working for Mueller at that point.
Yeah, I was working for Mueller and I was in a car when I heard about the Barr summary. And I just thought that the reports I was hearing over the radio just had to be wrong. Everyone expected that he was just going to release if he wanted to do a summary. We wrote summaries of the report. We thought, oh, well, we did that so he can just release those. And of course, he wrote his own. And by the way, just say something positive about Merrick Garland. I mean, this is one where if you want to know any time a summary would be vindicated to say this report vindicates the principal, it would be the Rob Herr report vindicates Joe Biden. You know, there was no crime there. I mean, it's so similar to Mike Pence, whereas Bill Barr spun it the other way when he wrote a purported summary that wasn't. I'd have to say that's to Merrick Garland's credit that he was not trying to do that. He was like, you know what, it is what it is. I think where you can fault Merrick Garland is that he does have an obligation if he thinks that it violated DOJ rules. He could have pushed back. There would have been political upheaval. He would have been accused of, you know, trying to change it or doing it for political reasons. But you know what? That's why they pay you the big bucks. If you're not doing it for political reasons and you're doing it because it is gratuitous besmirching of someone who is not being charged, that's your job. And the fact that you're going to be falsely accused of doing it for political reasons is not a reason not to do it. That goes very much back to the initial appointment issue where I think, you know what? Pick the best person. And as a friend of mine said, in a nutshell, the appointment of Rob Herr was fundamentally a political decision, small p, not a merit decision. You were not picking the best person for the job. You were trying to find a qualified person who would not get sort of blowback because this person is of the same party as the person being investigated.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Theda Scotch-Pohl is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University and the author of Rust Belt Union Blues, Why Working Class Voters Are Turning Away from the Democratic Party. Welcome to Fast Politics, Professor Scotch-Pohl.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So great to have you. I just really wanted you to come on the podcast to talk a little bit about the Tea Party and how it relates to where we are right now. Because I feel like we don't spend enough time talking about the sort of, we are the United States of Amnesia, and we don't spend enough time talking about just the very recent history.
Right. Well, you know, the Tea Party erupted, of course, soon after Barack Obama was elected in 2008, took office in 2009. Along with Democratic control of both houses of Congress. At that time, that kind of trifecta of control for one party was a rare occurrence. And even while Barack Obama was running for office, but certainly after he was elected with Democrats in control of the federal government, conservative people in the United States were, I would say, startled and terrified.
Right.
And within a very short period of time, the activists among them dressed up in costumes and started running demonstrations that suggested that the America they believed in was at stake with this presidency, a message amplified by conservative media. So we all know that demonstrations occurred from then on. My colleagues and I also honed in on the fact that over the next couple of years, up to 2,000 regularly meeting local Tea Party groups, volunteer groups of people protesting Democrats and the Obama presidency, took to the field in the United States. And by 2011, my co-author Vanessa Williamson and I were out in the field in several states of the United States interviewing grassroots activists. We weren't contenting ourselves with what national polls said or with what national spokespeople on TV said. We were actually talking to the grassroots activists and attending some of their Tea Party meetings. Those people, older, white, conservative-minded people, overwhelmingly were fascinated by Donald Trump while we were in the field interviewing.
Oh, wow. Even then?
I can remember one lady saying to me that she was intrigued because grassroots Tea Partiers were not enthusiastic about Mitt Romney as a possible candidate for the GOP in 2012. And that was the time when Donald Trump was making a name for himself by challenging Barack Obama's birth certificate and his citizenship. And that fascinated some of those grassroots activists. And I remember thinking at the time, if he were running, he would be a very attractive candidate for these people. Now, flash forward over the years, we know that surviving Tea Partiers, activists, people who told national pollsters that they sympathized with the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, and ultimately people elected to Congress, especially after 2010, who considered themselves Tea Party supporters, they have been all along and still are, if they're alive and still in office, they are the core of the most enthusiastic MAGA supporters. And I can say that partly because I continued personally to go into the field and interview very conservative people after Donald Trump was elected. And those still meeting, there were still some Tea Parties meeting as late as 2017, and they were gung-ho for Donald Trump. But we also know from national polls in recent years that those who say they were active in the Tea Party or sympathetic with it are very exercised about immigration and very supportive of Donald Trump and his attempts to build a wall around America.
I want to go back to what you said a little bit earlier when we were talking about this, because I don't know that I realized exactly the timing on this. They didn't like Mitt Romney because he felt insufficiently, I want to say racist, but what was the complaint about Mitt Romney?
Well, I think the accurate term is ethno-nationalist, because Tea Party people have been, and MAGA people still are, very exercised about immigration into the United States, particularly by people of non-European origin, as well as upset about African Americans gaining political power. This is an ethno-nationalist view of the world that you could call racist. I prefer the ethno-nationalist term. But Look, Mitt Romney was not satisfactory to Tea Partiers for the same reason that all of the people running against Donald Trump in 2015 that were dispensed by him one after another in the Republican primaries were not as acceptable. There's a sense that the Republican establishment has not responded over the years, or didn't until recently, until it was Trumpified, to what are the most intense concerns of grassroots conservatives. And those concerns certainly included putting a stop to immigration, making sure that Black political power in and through the Democratic Party does not go too far. For some of them, maybe about half, going back to a more traditional family roles and limiting access to abortion and other kinds of rights for women.
Right. And birth control goes with that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Really a whole set of it. And also just tension about, well, professional women.
I can't believe we're having this conversation.
Hillary Clinton was in some ways the perfect emblem of that. So, I mean, all of these concerns are kind of piled on top of each other and have created a movement that I think goes in a straight line from the Tea Party to the MAGA movement, although the MAGA movement includes more younger men than the Tea Party originally did, that they think the kind of America they believe in is being stolen, is being taken away from them. And Donald Trump is admired because he tells it like it is and because he's promising to bring back the real America. And one Tea Partier that I interviewed as late as 2017, still meeting in his Tea Party. And when I finally got around to the end of the interview, and I said, well, you know, I'm not sure he's really going to build that wall. My interviews are very, very, I'm listening. I'm not preaching people. But toward the end of an interview, I will kind of gently raise. He said, it doesn't matter because his heart's in the right place. He's trying. And, you know, I want to say that there's nothing foolish about that. I think people in general partly make decisions about politicians in terms of whether they're trying, whether they seem to be on your side, whether they seem to express your values. So I didn't think that there was anything scandalous about what he said or surprising, but that's what he said.
I think that's a really important point, right? That this is not, you know, people don't vote for candidates because, I mean, they know that politics are not an ATM. When we talk about this group, I always think of this as the kind of America's, like, and maybe this is overly optimistic, as America's last gasp before a possible multiracial democracy, that we are in the sort of democratic growing pains, small d. Do you think that's right? Or do you think I'm being overly optimistic? And what supports or doesn't this idea?
I'm teaching a course right now in which we're looking back at that period from the end of the Civil War through the turn of the 20th century, when a multiracial democracy or possibilities for it briefly emerged, actually took shape during congressional reconstruction, and then was brutally rolled back and ultimately snuffed out legally for decades. Now, I have to hope, I'm an old lady now, so I won't live to see it, that nothing like that could happen now. Things move faster. But we are definitely in a period where outright reversal, not just stopping progress toward a multiracial democracy, but outright reversal of the rule of law and of participatory accountability for our government is at stake. And that's because once Donald Trump was elected, and it was a fluke election in many ways, a lot of things had to come together to give him that minority win through the Electoral College in 2016. From then on, it's not just Donald Trump, is it? It's an entire political party that has bought into even the most extreme. Harvard graduates like Elise Stefanik are suggesting that we should have what amounts to a dictatorship in this country. There are a lot of people now invested in the project of holding minority authoritarian power and exercising it with cruelty and fierceness against those who are opposed. And that has happened in U.S. history before. It has happened in many countries' histories before. It could happen here.
Yeah. I'm like struck by what you're saying because it does seem Trump was just Trump, right? He was not the party until systematically he and his people basically removed everyone who wasn't him. I think you saw it really in this most recent primary contest, right? You did see DeSantis ran as mini Trump. And I actually was more anxious about DeSantis because I felt like DeSantis had taken the scary authoritarianism that is Trumpism, but was also much smarter. Ultimately, Trump's people were attached to him in a way that couldn't be transferred to DeSantis. Is that a good sign, or am I just being optimistic to be optimistic?
DeSantis, I don't know how smart he is, and an unlikable and non-entertaining person, if there ever was one. And I would not argue that he embraced all of Trumpism. I think this whole anti-DEI thing is a middle-class version of Trumpism. It's people who attended colleges and felt like they weren't in the mainstream. You know, at least Stefanik stands up for that, too, thinking that the fight over Harvard is the... I don't think ordinary grassroots Trump supporters are all that interested in that battle. I think they're much more interested in blocking immigration and carrying through kind of the use of government power to regulate what they would like to see as the ability to win elections by real Americans, which they think of themselves as, and getting back at those who they feel have dissed them, who have taken the reins of cultural and economic dynamism in this country and passed them by. Remember, people who are overwhelmingly for Trump and therefore live in communities where everybody likes Trump are exurban to not so much rural as small town. There's a sharp geographic divide. And of course, those are areas that have a lot of extra leverage in the Electoral College, the Senate, and in gerrymandered legislatures.
So those are the states with not a lot of electoral votes.
Well, they're also the people who are beyond the circle of counties around Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, which I've studied closely. You know, they're very competitive. I mean, they captured both Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan in 2016, and Joe Biden only kind of inched his way back to better margins in some of those outlying areas. It starts right at the edge of the inner ring of suburbs around the metropoli in every state.
Is it right to believe, not morally right, but correct, to believe that what is happening in this country is a divide, largely, not always true, but that people who are more educated tend to be Democrats and people who are less educated tend to be Republicans, with the exception of the very wealthy?
Well, both parties are cross-income and cross, to a lesser degree, cross-educational credentials coalitions. The Democrats are a coalition of college-educated, with more and more college-educated who used to be moderate Republicans moving toward the Democrats, especially in dynamic metropolitan areas. But they are also dependent on a constituency of lower-income people of color who live in the cities. And those people are drifting away to some degree. The Republicans are a coalition of, I would say, small business type people, construction type people, middle class people in more religious areas, more right wing religious areas of the country, and a fair number of blue collar workers. Although I think our tendency to think of all Trumpers as non-college educated is not quite right. It's right overall, but there are a lot of college educated people that are bought into this.
Which is a terrifying sentence in itself, right? Talk to me about the dependency Democrats have on these lower income voters and why they're leaving the Democratic Party.
Well, I think some of the men among them are tempted. But let's think about it. I mean, the Democrats have been, and there's a new paper out by Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson that really does a brilliant job of showing that the Democratic coalition has been reinvented recently among using government spending pretty aggressively to both address concerns that college-educated voters have, like the environment, and to try to deal with some of the lower-income people's needs, particularly their needs for family supports. So the Democratic Party is not AOC, but they've put together a more progressive economic program that speaks to the needs of a very broad cross-class coalition in the metropolitan areas. The trouble is the Republicans have enough power to block a lot of that. And if you look at not just what happens in a lot of state legislatures, but look at what happened with Build Back Better, it started out with a really bold redistributive, that is equality enhancing set of proposals. And as it finally made it through, a lot of the things like the child tax credit, which had reduced poverty enormously, were stripped away. Partly because of Republicans and partly because of Joe Manchin. If you can't deliver, if you promise and you can't deliver, which is the Democrats' dilemma, they can get to 50-50, but they can't quite get enough federal power to deliver, and they've lost the courts. That is something that Trump thrives on. Trump thrives on the idea that appeals to many non-college people that, oh, if just a powerful president would just cut through all this nonsense and just do things. And of course, Trump will promise anything to anybody. He will in this election. He's going to promise everything. And a lot of people don't even pay attention till the last minute. And of course, the media system completely magnifies everything Trump says, while mainly broadcasting legal cases that the college-educated people are following, which really turn off blue-collar people. I mean, they're just not interested in whether the 14th Amendment his officers or offices. Oh, come on. You know, let's face it, that's ridiculous. So Trump thrives on not getting things done.
Okay. Thank you so much, Professor. This was so interesting. And so I hope you will come back.
Sure. Let's make sure we don't hit one of the cases that the college educators are following.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jongfast, you know what violence I love? There's only one type. Crazy Texas Republican on crazy Texas Republican violence.
The best. It's worth remembering that as much as Democrats and Republicans have ire between each other, this Republican Party really, really has a lot of ire. So here we go. Ken Paxton, AG, you will remember they tried to impeach him once. He is trolling John Cornyn, who, again, this is like Paxton is MAGA MAGA. So he's mad at John Cornyn for voting to send aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The thinking here is that sending this humanitarian aid, some of this is military aid, will prevent further conflicts, but it doesn't matter because MAGA Ken Paxton wants to score the points with the MAGA base, and so he is now declared war on John Cornyn. There are no winners here, only losers.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Got menopause? We've got you. Hi, Jackie here, founder of ExoJackie. Feel supported throughout your menopause journey and beyond with our organic protein powders and symptom relief boosts. Formulated to keep bones and muscles strong, ExoJackie products help reduce bloating, hot flashes, and weight gain. Enjoy 20% off with promo code EXOPODCAST. Shop now at ExoJackie.com. Made for women by women.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.